Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. Well, that song is familiar to everybody who's listening to this podcast, young and old. The classic theme from the Dick Van Dyke Show, just one of the classic shows of all time, created by Carl Reiner and Danny Thomas and others. And it's as alive today as it was back then. And one of the great characters in that show, and so much to talk about that a lot of this will surprise you, of course, was Rose Marie. She played Sally Rogers. She was one of the writers in the writing room for the Alan Brady Show. And there's a lot of history that goes along with that show, but there's a lot of history that goes along with that woman, that actress, that singer, that performer, who was and is as sharp a performer back then as she is today. And you're going to learn a lot about her life, because there is a new documentary movie out. It's called Wait for Your Laugh. There's a reason for that title. And it talks about this woman who's been around from vaudeville to radio to Vegas to Broadway, television, you name it. She's been there, probably the longest career in showbiz history of any actress, and she is Rose Marie. Now, Rose Marie was to join us for this interview. She is a bit under the weather. And but talking to her, talking instead of Rose Marie, we're perfect. In perfect hands here, because we are joined by Peter Marshall, the longtime host of Hollywood Squares, who worked with Rose for so many different years as she filled the square and asked questions. And he, in his own right, a Broadway star, television star, singer, maybe we'll have him sing. Peter, thank you for joining us to talk about the Rose Marie movie.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Happy holiday and all that kind of stuff.
And to you. And Jason Wise, he's had very little to do with this film, unless you consider writing it, producing it, directing it, editing it, something. I guess I do. And so he's kind enough to spend some time talking about what was, I know, a project of love for him. And now we get to talk about it. And Jason, welcome to the podcast as well.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, Jason, I'm actually going to start with you, because I think the impetus for Wait for Your Laugh for this movie, it had to have started in your world and said, we need to study, we need to take a close look at the career and the life of Rose Marie. What triggered that? Were you a longtime Dick Van Dyke fan, or were you a Rose Marie fan who, you know, kind of was familiar with her from the baby Rose Marie's days?
You know, this project came about, my wife and I are big fans of entertainment history. And I know that sounds like a strange thing because it's very broad. But Christina and I were trying to figure out how to tell a story about how we have changed the mediums in which we entertain ourselves. You know, going back to vaudeville and radio and theater and then television and film. And we struggled for quite a long time as to who we could use as a vessel to tell that kind of a story. And this film was going to be very different. I did not come at it from the Dick Van Dyke Show. In fact, originally I thought maybe Mickey Rooney was our main character.
Oh, wow.
And by...
Now, was Mickey still alive at the time you were pondering that?
He was. And my first film had come out and been very successful. That was about wine. And I started looking into it. Mickey's health was starting to fade. And, you know, I have to say, I, like most people who have seen this movie now, really truly did not understand anything close to the scope of Rosemary's career. And because we made this film over the course of about 4 years, I have become incredible friends and also a huge, huge admirer of this woman. You know, it came about very naturally, and we realized very quickly we had in our hands probably one of the greatest American treasures in entertainment. And, I mean, it could be quite a long story as to how we came about this, but the whole film changed to be a story about Rose Marie instead of a story about entertainment.
Wow. And, of course, I've seen the movie, and I'm going to say this again, but it's opening in Chicago on January 12th at the Facets Theater, which is just a great location for these kinds of documentaries and projects. And I was fascinated by the movie. I mean, I, at first when I watched something like this, I thought, I'm going to probably have to do this in phases. And I just couldn't stop. I watched it right through. And because it's so well done, it's not just got archival footage, but, you know, you use some actors, you use some things in there to create the people who were involved in her life. And Peter Marshall, let me come to you, because like Jason, there's a lot about Rose Marie I didn't know. Like, for example, the mob loved her. I mean, she knew Al Capone. There were people who were in her life. Did you know that about her life early on, or did you learn some of this stuff, Peter, as this project continued?
I've known Rose for many, many, many years, and we've been pals. And yes, I knew her mother, and I Yeah, I knew all about her life. In fact, when I was Rose, I think 95. I'm 91, and
youngster.
I can remember as a kid listening to KDKA out of Pittsburgh. You know, Baby Rosemary on radio. I mean, she was as she was a huge star on radio. I mean, big. She was as big as I've always equated her as like Shirley Temple in film.
Yeah,
that's what Rosemary was in radio, and she was this child star. She was 3 or 4 years old when she started. And then, you know, the film shows how she went from radio into vaudeville into, you know, into nightclubs into television, you know. It's an amazing career. I didn't know her father, of course, but I knew her mom and Noopy, her daughter. Her career is just phenomenal. And when I started Squares, I was thrilled to have her a part of the family, you know. We've been pals for a long, long time, as I stated. Yes, I knew everything about Roe.
Well, and by the way, I'm going to have one little Hollywood Squares point I want to mention, because, of course, you had the classics, Paul Linden, Charlie Weaver, and actually my good friend Kathy Garver was also on the show from time to time. One thing, a lot of people thought that was set up. They knew the questions. The humor was prepared. Peter, can you confirm right here and now that was just not true?
It was not true. It was people were given jokes, but they never knew the straight line. I never knew the joke. It was done very cleverly, and of course, Paul was a big part of it, as was Roe, as Cliff Arquette and Wally Cox and George Gobel. You know, George Gobel's a Chicago boy.
That's right.
I've known, for the most part, I knew every star for a long time. I knew Cliff Arquette from the time I was 18. And George Gobel, I knew when he sang country songs, and he was working a little bar in Chicago called Helsing's. Wow. And he was little Georgie Gobel singing country too.
They all started off with the lip. Paul Lind, of course, went to Northwestern, by the way. Well, for Rose Marie, as you said, little Georgie Gobel, well, it was little Rose Marie. And I think, you know, I didn't know about that early on when I was a kid watching Dick Van Dyke. But for folks who didn't know that, as Peter says, she was a star at age 3 and age 4, here's a little bit of what baby Rose Marie sounded like.
Hey, hey, no doubt you've heard about the sweetest man in Dixieland. I'll say he's hot, he's got just what it takes to make a ladies' man. When he struts along and swings his cane, husbands tie their wives up with a bow and chain. He's just a sentimental gentleman from
great
Georgia.
Stuff. You know, Jason, what I find interesting about that is when you actually listen to the lyrics she's singing and her style of singing, you know, Peter mentioned sort of a Shirley Temple thing, but the truth is, man, baby Rose Marie sounded like she was 25 when she was 3. I mean, she sounds like an adult. I don't mean in terms of the tone of her voice, but what she's singing, what she brings to those songs, she was pretty mature for a young lady.
Yeah, well, I think
there's the actual film of her when she was 3 and 4 singing on radio.
Right.
They always talk about people who are born with, you know, a talent. She is.
Yeah, and such strength. And the other thing, Jason, is she grows up. I mean, again, we see her for Dick Van Dyke fans. I'm making a bit of an assumption that that's a lot of people's introduction to her, depending on your age. But you see her as kind of the second banana in the office. The truth is, actually, and I'll ask Jason this question. She actually, when they were doing the Dick Van Dyke show, she was a bit disappointed because she was intended to be, and she thought she was going to be the star of that show, right?
Well, I mean, she was one of the big.
And she was, of course.
Yeah, but I mean, prior to, you have to understand what happened. First of all, the first season of the Dick Van Dyke Show was an unmitigated flop.
Right, canceled.
I mean, it was a disaster. I mean, it was a very, very, very stressful situation for Carl. They were up against a lot of well-established things. And then they went to reruns. And you have to understand, when they went to reruns, America really picked up on Mary Tyler Moore's character. And she became, you know, I always think it's hilarious that Mary in that show got a lot of progressive focus because she wore pants.
Right.
And here you had Rosemary working as a woman just in a job, just walking the walk. And so I think it was very frustrating to her that America latched on to Mary Tyler Moore, who in her own right is an amazing talent and a beautiful person. But from Rosemary's perspective, you can imagine how frustrating that was. She was supposed to be one of the absolute, and she was a major character, but she was supposed to be, you know, probably the second big person on the show.
Yeah. There is a little bit in the movie, and I've read so much about that show and that history as well. And Peter, maybe in your personal relationship, that there was a bit of, jealousy, negativity between Mary Tyler Moore and Rose Marie, maybe just some professional jealousy going on. Did they patch that up? What was their relationship like?
Yeah, I can answer that. I can answer that. So basically, I can tell you that when Rose Marie came to the Dick Van Dyke Show, she had lived 5 lifetimes of entertainment. She was coast to coast famous before Shirley Temple was even born. And Mary Tyler Moore, in Rose Marie's eyes, was just this newbie who had done nothing except a little bit of Broadway or off Broadway. I mean, she really was not. You can imagine. So she was, right. Rose Marie was this veteran, very talented person. So there was a lot of, it was kind of oil and water between the two of them. And they did not get along very well. In fact, I think I made it look a lot better than it probably was in the film. But what happened was when they did their reunion many, many years later, they did the reunion show many years later, they patched everything up. And, they were always cordial working together, but I wouldn't say they were friends at all. But they patched it up when they did the reunion show.
Yeah, and Peter, Rose, as I watched this movie, one of the messages I take out of it was she was, almost like a Lucille Ball. She was a businesswoman. She understood what it meant to be a talent. And in fact, the movie called Wait for Your Laugh, the notion is she could look at other comedians and comedians and explain to them how to play an audience, how to play a laugh. A true, Peter, consummate professional.
Oh, absolutely. you can't be in the business for, 70 years without learning a lot. And she knew how everything was structured. But you're right. She thought she was going to be the star of the show. And next to Dick Van Dyke, it was the Dick Van Dyke show. And, when it started, it's in the movie. What's a Dick Van Dyke?
Right.
He had been on Broadway with Bye Bye Birdie, and the next thing you know, he's doing this situation comedy. And she'd been around for 70 years and had starred with Milton Berle and Jimmy Durante and Benny and, all the great classic guys. And so she was a little taken aback when Mary Tyler Moore became the focus of the show. And which was kind of strange to me because the old performers like a Jack Benny or a George Burns, everybody around them, even though it was the Jack Benny show, the announcer was funny, Don Wilson,
right.
The band leader, Phil Harris, was funny, the singer, Dennis Day,
Rochester Eddie Anderson, right.
Yeah, and that kind of surprised me because the play is the thing, and not the star. The play is the thing, and Carl Reiner realized that, and he gave her the option of saying, "Listen, honey, I understand. If you're unhappy, take a cab." And that's when she realized that she was in really good company with Mary Tyler Moore and Ed Asner and Van Dyke.
Jason,
she stuck it out, and
yeah.
Thank goodness she did because it was wonderful for her career.
And Jason, she had one true love in her life, right? Bobby Guy was something. We get that story and we get it told so well and so much video. They had a daughter, but I, to be honest, again, that was something I didn't even know before I saw the movie. This truly was the love of her life and very rough for her when he passed and she lost him.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to understand, Bobby Guy, I think, is one of the most underrated trumpet players America has ever produced. But Rosemary, she guarded her personal life because I don't think she really thought of her. Her goal was not to be famous. This is a woman who just wants to work. So, where a lot of people, they live their life completely in show business. Rose Marie was a very blue-collar showbiz star is how I would equate her. And when Carl Reiner first saw the film, he said, I don't know what I'm more amazed by, that I didn't know so much of this woman's story who I've known her whole life, or that you made a good movie about someone who didn't do drugs, didn't drink, and was married to the same man her whole life. And,
really.
It's kind of a, she's somebody to look up to. She truly walked the walk and is a very, very, very good person. I wouldn't want to be in a fight with her. but she's a very good person.
And Peter, one of the things also told in the story, I mean, I didn't know that there was a relationship, but what I mean, a friendship between Rosemarie and Jerry Lewis. And yet when Bobby got sick, she, and you talk about this, Jason, in the film, Jerry Lewis sent, you know, a certain doctor over there who he directed, you need to help him, because they didn't know what was wrong with him and what was going on. Peter, did you know, just out of curiosity, did you know Bobby?
I worked with Bobby, yeah. I
there
worked with him on the Les Brown band and the NBC band. And I did Manhattan Tower, the Gordon Jenkins thing. I started with Helen O'Connell, and Bobby was in the band. Yeah, I knew Bobby. I didn't pal around with Bobby. I did. He wasn't a close friend, but I certainly admired what he did. And the funny thing is, he was such a calming influence for Ro, because Ro has always been kind of hyper and working and doing and going. You know, she's had to survive. And Bobby was a laid back kind of easy guy who took care of her and changed her life, really. And so when he passed, and he passed at a very young age,
yes,
it just it was, you know, it was really hard for her. And she's very had a very hard life. I mean, well, if you see the film, you'll realize what I'm talking about. Her father was really a low key mobster. You know, he was an arsonist.
Yeah, right.
And
she didn't like him.
And he had another completely another family with the same names, by the way, of Rosemarie and her brother. And you know, she's had to fight all of her life, and so Bobby, when Bobby came along, it got good, really good,
yeah.
And so when he left, it was really tough on her.
And Jason, when you know, when she goes to Vegas, I mean, this was the beginning, the Flamingo Hotel. She's a headliner. This is when we get a lot of the names like the Bugsy Siegels, and this is who created Vegas. It looked like there's some great stories in the movie, too, where she would, you know, talk back to somebody not realizing that it's some, you know, mafia guy. But, you know, it almost didn't matter to her. She was a star. She wanted to be paid. You have a story in the movie where her check is, what, $11 or $12 short. She demands that money from a mafia boss. She was tough.
Oh, yeah. I think part of why she was treated so much like one of the guys, because in 5 seconds you sort of, you don't have anything else to look at her as an equal. I mean, she walked the walk as an equal. And I mean, definitely. I mean, she went seriously, you know, Bugsy Siegel and all these people were, she always says, he was just my boss. You know, he was the guy who owned the club I performed at.
And so, he was.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, but she's very matter of fact about this stuff. And she is a tough, you can't use the word broad very much anymore, but she is a tough broad.
I have to tell you, I was going to use that word when I described her, because, and I know it's inappropriate, so I didn't. But you're right, in that day and of that generation, it's almost the way you have to describe her. Peter, when I think of her, I mean, again, she's a name, and you see this movie and you realize what a star she is. But and maybe let me get your perspective on this. When you are talking about Vegas talent these days, I mean, I don't know. She doesn't roll off the tongue like Frank Sinatra and Jerry Lewis and the folks who are Dean Martin, Rat Pack, those kinds of guys. Yet she worked in those circles. Do you think did she reach in those days? Did she reach the pinnacle of success of those guys? But we just don't have the sense of it today. I mean, you get it from the movie that she certainly should have.
I can't really comment on it. I mean, she always worked, and she was always a headliner. If she wasn't starring, she was the co-star, and she's one of those people that's never been out of work. You know, she. Because what she did was so professional and so good, and people adored her. And you must remember, it's in the movie. By the way, we talk about Chicago a lot in the movie.
That's right.
Chicago's featured really very much so, and they've recreated Jason and Christina. They've recreated Chicago. It's phenomenal. I just love what Jason has done to this movie, but she was a very big star in vaudeville and in nightclubs and people respected her and people adored her. She was always there. She was tough, but she did her job, and that's, you know, if I own a nightclub, I want somebody that's going to be there every night and be in top form, and that's what she was. She is the top, she is a professional, and she's. I've never seen her dog anything. She's always there. She's I just love her to death.
And I'll tell you, one of the great things about Carl Reiner, who I think we would all agree is a genius, and when he put together that little Dick Van Dyke show, which, of course, had to find its audience and did, it's never gone away, one of the things he let them do was, because I know one of the issues, I know Rosemarie always thought the focus of the show was going to be the writers in the newsroom, and you have it in the movie, Jason, where Carl had to kind of say to Rosemarie, no, it's really Rob and Laura Petrie. It's really about that relationship, and this is the office is sort of secondary, but one of the things Carl did, he let everybody perform. He let everybody be who they are and show their talents. Rosemarie was known for some impressions. She did a great one of Jimmy Durante. I will never forget, it's embedded in my head, when she did the Durante song, not only on stage, but she did it in the Dick Van Dyke, Dyke show. So for folks who are listening, if they haven't heard it, here's your chance. Little Rosemarie doing Jimmy Durante.
I wish I could sing like Durante. Jimmy's got the voice I love. I wish I could hit those high notes. That's the one that I'm speaking of. I wish I could sing that small child that was holding. I was holding fellas where you keep it down, small child. I was
just so great. And Peter, that was critical in the show, right? I mean, I think part of the brilliance of the show, the Dick Van Dyke show, and you know all those players. Look, she brought Maury Amsterdam into the show, and she had a sense along, and Carl let her play it out to be who they are, to entertain. And I think it's why that show is endearing today.
Speaking of Maury Amsterdam, there's another terrific professional. I mean, he was an accomplished cellist. I mean, he was a phenomenal cellist.
Right.
He wrote great jokes. He was the sweetest, kindest man that one could ever imagine. And when she brought Maury into the Van Dyke show, that was a stroke of genius. And Carl talks about that, you know?
Absolutely. Jason, as the years go on, one of the things, and you both sort of said this, one of the things about Rosemarie is always wanted to work. You're never going to find her. She would get you have a scene in the movie when, and of course, she's herself in the documentary, but where, you know, she would get it. She talks about getting a phone call, and, you know, if she was off a certain day, she would take a job. But in a period of time when she was getting roles that even she didn't think she was right for, and what I have in mind is Gunsmoke, where she was playing an older mother, and she said, this isn't me, but she did it, and you have that clip in the movie, and she's phenomenal at everything she does.
Yeah, this is the thing. I mean, she was definitely, you know, she was definitely somebody who could just walk on set, and I think it comes from decades and decades and decades of just knowing how to be on. I mean, she has a true innate ability to do this. And you spoke earlier about her just as a child sounding like an older person. I think it's more that she just was fearless. I mean, she would hear music that she liked and she would absolutely copy it.
Yeah.
And it goes to like walking on set or doing anything. She just demanded respect. And she was born with, people throw that around so much. You were born with talent. Well, not many actually are. They got to really, really, really hone it. Rosemarie was born with talent.
When I was watching the movie, I was just taking notes for myself, knowing we'd eventually talk, and I just wrote down to myself, she is tough. But I also wrote the word ego down. Peter, is it fair to say, and look, I do the news here, it kind of comes with the territory, but if you're in the business of show, ego comes as part of it, does it not?
Oh, absolutely. Hey, listen, walking out, you got to, when you walk out on the stage, kid, you better have a really good feeling that you're pretty good at what you do, you know? And if you go out there feeling insecure, it's just not the best way to go on a stage. Yeah, she knew she was good, and she was good. And ego, as long as you don't show it, you know, an egocentric, but no, you've got to have you've got to say to yourself, hey, I'm doggone good at what I do. And she was doggone good at what she did.
And still doing it. I want to ask both of you about this, Jason. Four Girls, Four. I have a feeling that show was probably playing in Chicago when I was around, and I don't know how I missed it. I wouldn't miss it if it came back. It's not coming back. But talk to me about the creation of Four Girls, Four, because it was Rose, it was Rosemarie Clooney, Margaret Whiting, Helen O'Connell. And talk to me about why that show got put together. There were some questions as to whether it would work. And even the relationships between those ladies were really interesting. And then I'll get Peter's take on it.
Yeah, okay.
First, I'm going to get Jason to kind of set us up. And Peter, I'm going to come to you for your take.
All right, so the Four Girls Four, thing was basically, you know, you have to know these were a bunch of gals in their 60s, early 60s. And, you know, if you think it's tough for, especially women, I mean, let's be honest, to get roles at that age now, imagine it, you know, 20 years ago. It was even harder. And so Four Girls Four kind of came out of, you know, Helen O'Connell was one of the major people who started it up. But it came out of all of these four women really, really frustrated that they couldn't do what they had done for the last 60 years, which was perform in nightclubs, perform in venues, sing their songs, do their acts. And they believed there was an audience for it. And so they worked, to cut a very, very long process short, they worked very hard together to get their chance to prove that people still cared about them. And it exploded. It absolutely exploded.
Sold out audiences every night.
Yeah, and sold out, I mean, thousands of people in a lot of cases. And, you know, I mean, Rosemarie, she did not make a lot of money as a performer during her career. She made nothing from Baby Rosemarie. Her father took it all. She made very little on the Dick Van Dyke Show because of the way contracts were structured. She doesn't make anything from it now.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of the money, if she has any now, is from Four Girls Four. And I'm just so proud of her for doing that. But I will say there were definitely some tensions behind the scenes. And, I mean, Peter knows the gals who sang in it personally. I mean, I think, Peter, you performed with, Helen O'Connell for years and years. I think you can speak to some of the personalities.
Yeah. Peter, talk. Tell us about those ladies.
I was closer to Helen O'Connell than any of them because I knew Helen from the time I was 12. She was my sister's best friend. My sister was the actress Joanne Drew, and she was married to Dick Hames at one time.
Sure, yeah.
I toured with Helen. I did all the Bob Everly things and then I did Manhattan Tower with her. I mean, she was like my sister, and she's portrayed in the film. Nobody really liked her. I loved her to death, but she was tough. She had a drinking problem, and she was bossy, and Rose is bossy, so these two bossies, they collided. Not a pretty picture. And nobody was sweeter in the world than Maggie Whiting and Rosie Clooney. There was four terrific talents. A lot of people don't know this, but Helen left, and then Kay Starr came in, and other performers came in. I don't know. Jason's too young to remember the act, and you obviously didn't see it. It was a sensational act. And Frankie Ortega, he was the musical director. He was my musical director at one time. It was just so good. Four terrific-looking dames who could sing wonderfully, and they were all funny, but they were all different. And that was the charm of it. Four Girls Four, it was a great act. It really was. They've tried to do it since then, but they've never been able to accomplish it. And Ro was sort of the leader of the pack. She was the director. She's tougher than nails. Oh, my God. It was just talking about Four Girls Four make me laugh because they were all so different. But the friendly ones were Maggie and Ro and Helen. Yeah. I mean, and Rosie Clooney. They were just so sweet. But
that comes.
Jason, you should do a documentary on Four Girls.
Yeah, there you go. You should do that. And, well, I thought it's interesting too. One of the things Rose says in the films is she goes, referring to today, that really nobody does a good act anymore. And I kind of wonder. And Peter, I'll stick with you on this one. I mean, you know, we go to Vegas. I go to Vegas. It's just not what it was. I mean, I was a kid in the 60s, so I'm not saying I remember those days, but I've seen enough and I know enough of those kinds of shows because a lot of those performers are here in Chicago. It's not the same today. Peter, would all you guys be successful on the stage today, or is it a different world, do you think, Peter?
It's a different world. Musically, it's just ridiculous. You know, I don't understand the music of today. I've been in the business 76 years. I started out as a band singer. I worked the Shea Parade in Chicago. I worked Chicago Theater. I worked at the Palmer House. I worked, Chicago, what Vegas was, Chicago used to be. I don't know if you know this, but Chicago was the convention town long before Vegas because it was in the middle of the country.
Yeah.
And when people were out of work, we'd all go to Chicago and do club dates. I would be working the Chicago Theater, and then I could do, make you know, between shows, I'd go out and do club dates for all these different conventions.
How about Mr. Kelly's? You must have done Mr. Kelly's.
I never worked Mr. Kelly's. That was a little later on for me. I did a comedy act, Noonan and Marshall, and Tommy Noonan and Pete Marshall, and we were very big, especially in Chicago. I mean, I worked at Shea Paree for Dingy and Donjo. I knew all the guys. In the movie, we talk about working for the mob, and they were the best guys in the world to work for. They treated us wonderfully. As long as you were on the up and up, and they would do anything in the world for you. And, of course, Chicago, that's where they all were. That's where it all began, really.
True. Well, it may have begun in Chicago, but we see the whole history from vaudeville through Broadway, through Chicago. We see it all in just a masterfully edited film. Jason, I hope that lots of awards continue to come your way for this great, great documentary. And I did not know. It was interesting to hear you talk about the fact that it started out as one project and shifted to probably what it should be, which is the focus on the life of an incredible career. And that's Rose Marie. The movie is called Wait for Your Laugh. I can't let that go. You know what? I know why that is the title of the movie and where the line comes from. Jason, briefly, why is that the title of the movie? Who said that line? I mean, she did, but why?
Right. Well, I mean, so Dick Van Dyke was having a very hard time with the lines that were written and the improv that existed on the Dick Van Dyke Show. And Rose Marie would always yell at him that he was messing up. He's not waiting for his laugh. The line is set up for you to say it and then shut up for a second and then start talking again after the audience laughs. And Dick would have a hard time in rehearsal because there's no studio audience. So he didn't know how to feed off of them. He's a theater guy.
Right.
Rose Marie's, you know, she's done it all. So her thing was, you know, and she kept saying, wait for your laugh. And she would elbow him and go, wait for your laugh, wait for your laugh. She had, like, all sorts of funny names for him. And so I kind of kept that title because to me it means a lot of stuff. But originally it came from the fact that she told Dick to relax and have faith in your comedy and wait for your laugh because it'll come.
And that's why I think anybody who is a performer or loves studying entertainment needs to see this film. Again, it opens on January 12th in Chicago at the Facets Theater. And one day I'm sure we'll see it on DVD and available in other ways. It is called Wait for Your Laugh. Peter Marshall, just such an honor and treat to have you join me for this. Thank you so much. Again, I separately have so admired your career, watched every episode of Hollywood Squares, and maybe Jason and I will do a documentary on you.
Oh, I would love to do one on him. Peter's so fascinating and the sweetest man alive.
And I think a career that a lot of, again, people may know you from that, but you, Broadway man, you've done so many things. What a phenomenal career you have, and I wish you another 20 years of performing. God bless you, and thank you, Peter.
Oh, thank you so very much. I appreciate it.
And Jason, to you as well. You know, part of putting this movie together, I had an opportunity to get some things signed by Rose Marie. You may have known that I picked up some of those things. So adorning my walls are all sorts of things that were made available to help with the music rights and those kind of things for the movie. And I was glad to help out. And now I enjoy my own Rose Marie memorabilia that I have at home.
Wonderful.
And that's great. Jason Wise, the editor, co-writer, producer, director of an incredible film. It just impressed me so much. I was so excited when I heard about it. And I encourage everybody to see it at the Facets Theater on January 12th, starting on January 12th in the new year. Hey, you know what, guys? I don't know a better way to go out than to hear the voice of Rose Marie. It is holiday time. She was so well known in the Dick Van Dyke Show for singing a song about Santa. So with my thanks to both of you incredible men, I'm going to give the final word to Rose Marie.
I recall each Christmas when I was a child. Santa's gifts would make my little heart grow wild. But now that I'm a woman fully grown, there's just one gift I'd really love to own. To send a fella into my life, someone who is shopping around for a wife. I would like to order something Cary Granty, but I'd even settle for a James Durante. Santa, send a fella, that's my request. As long as he's still breathing, he passes the test. Forget the fancy paper and the pretty bow. Just wind him up, Santa, and let him go. Now your answer may be, dear madam, it's better to give him to receive. you're right. Give me an atom on Christmas Eve. I'll be waiting, Santa. Don't let me down.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.